This podcast is from Allegro Non Troppo on Joy Melbourne 94.9 radio station, Melbourne, Australia, and is produced for you by Adam, Peter and Robert. You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo here on the Community Radio Network with Adam and Peter, broadcast locally on radio station 3JOY. Today we're going to be catching up with some of the stories that we did during 2008 to see how these stories have developed. In particular, we're going to talk to Dr. Leslie Canold to talk about abortion, and we're going to talk to Neil Francis from Dying with Dignity. Locally in Melbourne at this time, it's World AIDS Day, and we're going to talk a little bit about some of the issues and some of the things to do with World AIDS Day. There's been a move around Australia and indeed around the world, now that HIV's been around for some time, Peter, that there's been cases where people have been charged with deliberately spreading HIV. Now, in the 80s and 90s, you would see, there was situations where people would attempt hold-ups and things, and they'd run in with a syringe full of blood and claim that it was contaminated with AIDS. And it was like a lethal weapon. But now we're seeing a different thing where people who have supposed to have deliberately infected other people are now coming under, they're coming under the law, and they're going to court and they're being sentenced. Now there's a few cases happening at the moment, so we have to be careful not to refer directly. The ones in Victoria, there are a few in Victoria, but there's one particular one where the conviction has happened but the sentencing is coming up. And I went through several of the community and government bodies to see if I could get a comment and get some information to find out what's happening and what this is all about and everything. And the thing that really surprised me, but I understand why, is nobody would talk to us. They wouldn't come on the show. They wouldn't make any comment. They didn't want to record any comment. And the criminalisation of HIV is a fairly serious issue. So in 2009, we'll be able to talk about this a little bit more. Because of the current circumstances and the rules of sub judice, we have to be fairly careful. But I would just get the impression that all of the people involved in the government agencies in particular want a particular outcome, and they don't want to talk about it. So that's fair enough. So we'll investigate this a little more in 2009 when this has happened. It's one of those things that sounds like an episode of Queer as Folk, doesn't it? Queer as Folk used to really take a particular issue and milk every side of it, and a lot of it was fantasy. And when they were going on about people wanting to be, this is on Queer as Folk, people wanting to be deliberately infected, and people deliberately wanting to infect other people, it all sounded like, oh, you know, you don't see somebody saying, I'm going to buy a pack of cigarettes because I want to catch cancer.
No,
I want to develop cancer.
I know from my own personal experience of at least one person who has said that they deliberately wanted to become infected.
Did they? Why?
Ah, dear. Why? I don't know. It just doesn't make sense to me. But there's some kind of misguided idea that it makes them closer to the person who they're in love with or something like that. I don't know.
Well, it was in a relationship with somebody who was positive. So he wanted to become positive so he could share that part of his life. That's not a healthy outlook,
it's
really.
It's not healthy,
is it?
But it does happen, though. I mean, if you're sceptical about this, I can tell you now it does. There are people who do that.
I was terribly sceptical. I didn't believe it for a long time. But then again, I have heard and read of some instances where people who engage in sexual behaviour, where they could contract HIV, and they don't want to use condoms, and because they just have no interest in using them and it ruins the experience for them, have then, well, the only way that I can put my mind at rest and stop fearing about getting HIV is if I become HIV positive, and then it's already happened, so then I don't have to worry about it anymore. But that is just such a huge, awful way to go about it.
Well, it's not that simple, is it? Because if you If you are HIV positive and you have unsafe sex, then there's always the risk of having a different strain of HIV, which can compound.
I think that's called superinfection. The superinfection. The other thing, as much as medical science has moved ahead, and you've got this situation now where HIV and AIDS is no longer regarded as a definite death sentence. You know, that these new drugs are proton infibulators or whatever, and all of the others are all extending people's lifespans. And a lot of people with HIV, it looks as though they're going to lead more or less normal lifespans.
Yeah.
Although I do hear that because of the toxicity of a lot of the HIV drugs, it does actually break down your organs and things a lot faster. So your lifespan may not be as long as a person who didn't have HIV, but it's going to be significantly longer than it was, say, 15 years ago.
Absolutely. We've seen people who have died some terrible deaths through HIV, and hopefully
shocking
for most people that's a thing of the past.
I don't wish to terrorise people who have HIV at the moment, but by way of deterrent to people who are thinking that, oh well, if I get it wouldn't be so bad, it's hideous.
Unfortunately, I think for young people, particularly in their teens, they think, oh, you know, even if I get infected, I'll live for a certain number of years. They think like even 15 years for them is nearly the whole lifetime away that they've already lived. So to them it seems a long, long time, but 15 years doesn't take long to go past.
No, the thing about HIV as well is it's really an insidious disease, because you can have it for quite a long time before you actually get any symptoms. And in a lot of people, especially, and we saw this in the early 80s and in the 90s, the first symptoms that they got were actually things that suddenly became life-threatening. And when it gets to that stage, to reconstruct an immune system is very, very difficult.
Well, I know someone who had these purple blotches appear on his face, and which was Kaposi's sarcoma. So it obviously had it for quite a while.
And Kaposi's sarcoma is like a skin cancer lesion thing. And once you get that, it grows very quickly. Although I think a lot of the opportunistic infections, the things that killed people in the early days, they can actually now take prophylaxis against them. So it's not such a serious thing. But there's still no cure, and there is no cure in sight, and there is no prevention. You can't have something to inoculate against HIV. And a few years ago, there was this huge promise that looks as though we've got a preventative vaccine for HIV. And what they found in the human trials is it actually seemed to make it worse. People became more at risk from getting it. I can't quote this example exactly. This is just what I recall, and it may be flawed. But I remember that there was some concern that not only did the vaccine not work, it didn't really make it any better. It actually made things worse. So there'll always be trials trying new vaccines. I think one of the things they're trying to do is look at the combination therapy that they use in HIV treatment and see with a vaccine if they can combine several vaccines together and maybe get one which is which comes together and is valid. So it validates and is effective, but it'll be a long way off. So up until that time, we urge all communities across Australia and indeed across the world, please act carefully. So where there are some people, but not very many, it would be maybe in one or two in a whole country, who go out deliberately to get infected because they can't cope with whatever, and they think by getting it, then I won't have to worry about getting it anymore. But the number of people going out deliberately infecting people, now, there are a few. There are a few, and it is a criminal event. It
offense.
Is a offence. As I said, I tried to get people from government departments and community organisations to talk about it today, but they won't. But hopefully they will next year, and then we can see and find out what's actually really happening. And it's interesting, if you look on Google around the world at criminal statistics from HIV, you get a little bit of a perspective. It's not very big, it's very small, but it makes great media stories.
Yes.
And that's wherein lies the danger. You're listening to Adam and Peter on Allegro Non Troppo on the Community Radio Network via satellite.
Leroy Anderson's Sleigh Ride.
This is Allegro Non Troppo across Australia on the Community Radio Network via satellite, the Digital Delivery Network, out of radio station 3JOY, Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station. We've been talking about AIDS, the impact of AIDS on the community, at time of going to where locally it's coming up to World AIDS Day, which is a significant event in the gay and lesbian community, particularly as we've lost so many people in our community. Peter, you and I have lost a lot of friends over the last 28 years.
Yes, we certainly have.
Or I'd like to say that we remember them particularly, and to people listening who don't know much about HIV/AIDS and how it has impacted on the gay and lesbian community, there was a time that in 1983, I think it was, I went with a group of men, a group of us went up to Sydney for a weekend. And we hired a bus because it was about 33, 34 of us. Mm. We went up in this bus for a weekend, and I just met this chap, so I was going up to spend the weekend with him, and this was just a cheap way of getting up for me. But they were all going up to a particular party. I don't exactly recall the details of the party, but I went with my friend and spent the weekend with him, and I came back on the bus with these guys, and I got to know the guys really well. I didn't know them as close friends.
Did you go to the party?
No, I didn't go to the party. But in 1996, the last one of those guys died.
Hmm.
They went to a party where there was sex happening. I don't know that it happened just at this party, but they all became infected with HIV, and they're all dead. Mm-hmm. And when I think back to that, I think, my God, I was so lucky not to be. I didn't go to that party, and now they're all dead. Mm. And it was that brings it back into stunning realization. They were nice guys. They were friendly, the easygoing, having fun, and just they all died slow, horrible deaths.
Well, at that time, nobody knew. No, you know, I mean, they wouldn't even think of condoms or anything.
No, this was before we'd even heard of HIV/AIDS, but it was around, but we hadn't heard of it.
You now, and I were on a counselling, we were part of a counselling service, and when we first heard about it, it was something that was happening over there, so to speak. It was in America, and we heard the first stories, and people were ringing up about it, and we were saying, don't worry about it. It's, you know, it's just something that's happening in America. It's not going to affect us.
Yeah, and then 2-3 years
what
later.
What horrendous advice that was.
Yes, and then look what happened. In the dying years between 1985 and 1995, one of the things I'll never forget, Peter, is opening up the newspaper, the gay and lesbian newspapers, and especially in Sydney. Because I lived in Sydney for some years, and I used to go up to Sydney a lot. And you'd open up the newspaper and there would be page after page of pictures and obituaries of people who died of HIV. And the number of times I'd open it up and there would be people I know who hadn't seen for a couple of years and there was their picture. They died. And the ironic thing is the guy that I went up to see during this bus trip, the bus trip of death, I'll call it, when I went up to see, I lost touch with him and actually didn't work out that weekend. And it was about 8 years later I went up to Sydney. I opened the paper and there was his picture.
Mm.
So he died as well. And when HIV first hit in Australia, in the initial first few years, there were a lot of people who seemed to be particularly sensitive to HIV, to the virus, and they got sick and died very quickly. So there was the first thing was this huge wave of people who died within a few years. And then came the second wave of people where it developed slowly and they got sicker and sicker and sicker. And the big turning point came in, I think it was 1995. It was not long after we started broadcasting here at 3JOY that they made this discovery of combination therapy. There was a new type of drug came out, and they found using the drugs that they'd tried that had failed, and using these new drugs, they're putting this combination together, all of a sudden it started to work, and people who were preparing to die suddenly were rescued from the abyss of death and put back into circulation as it was. And now a lot of those people have gone on to have normal, as far as possible, normal lives.
I know of one particular person springs to mind, who was a rather large person, quite overweight. He went down, his weight went down so badly he looked like a skeleton, and quite clearly his life was it's getting to the point where it was in the balance. And then these combination therapies came along. And within a fairly short time, he was back to how he was before.
Mm. Mind you, these new drugs, and from what I read and what I know of the people around me, they come at a price.
Mm.
Not only are they hideously expensive, but the long-term side effects from a lot of them can be quite serious. They are very toxic. A lot of them are very toxic. And I think it's called lipoatrophy, the condition that a lot of them get, where the body fat is redistributed and is wasting. And so if you're on some of these drugs for a long time, they strip away body fat. And while you're healthy in other ways, they get this terribly gaunt look. But there's drugs now that are trying to counter that. And the other one is it kills the ends of the nerves in the hands and the feet.
And that's peripheral neuropathy.
Is it? Peripheral neuropathy. Mm. And so that's a very painful situation as well. So that's a side effect of the drugs. And a lot of people who take HIV medications get really severe nausea and diarrhea. But I was chatting to my best friend who's a doctor some time ago. He was telling me that the new drugs that are coming out now, because they've got hindsight and they've been able to look at these drugs over the last 10 years and identify the elements that cause these side effects, they're managing to moderate them. So the side effects are becoming less and less and the drugs are becoming more effective. But still, if you want to survive, you have to take them. Now, wouldn't it be better if you didn't have to take them at all?
Absolutely, yes.
So there's no cure coming in the foreseeable future. So we say to people in the community out and around Australia, please be very, very careful in what you do. And heed the safe sex message. And everybody will say to you, look, condoms are the way to go and stuff like that. Look, the real situation with condoms, and let me tell you from personal experience, they're awful.
No, they're not.
They are. But if you want to survive and you don't want to get HIV, you have to use them. That's it.
Mm.
It's not a compromise. Well, I'll use them sometimes. The best way to live your life and engage with other people in the community is to do this. Assume everybody you meet has HIV. If you assume everybody has HIV, then you have a fairly good strategy for minimising your own danger.
You know, I know a little bit about the advances in condom technology, if I can put it that way, because where I work, we do a lot of work involving condoms.
Do you really?
Yeah.
What do you do?
Advertising.
Oh, right. You don't actually make them or test drive them.
We don't make them or test drive. We don't get free samples or anything. But they are advancing to this point where, while it's not quite the same as what's euphemistically called bareback, it's not too far off.
Okay. I have a particular problem with condoms myself.
Yeah, but I think there's probably more small psychological. Oh, it's probably more psychological than practical. Stop looking furtively.
What? I can't buy these little made in China ones, I'm sorry.
Made in China.
I have to buy the full German sausage variety. You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo here on the Community Radio Network. You know, Peter, I've been marking a lot of Year 12 papers for music, and one of the things that is quite distressing is the number of the people who did the papers, and they did it in handwriting, and they spelled Handel with an L-E. Two Z's in Mozart.
Yes.
Rachmaninoff with double F. Never mind. Joining us on the telephone on the Community Radio Network is Dr. Leslie Kenold. Hello, Dr. Kenold.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for coming back onto the Community Radio Network. We wanted to catch up with you to find out how everything went with the decriminalisation of abortion in Victoria.
And I'm here to report that we had a fantastic, fantastic outcome. So the bill was passed into law in October.
Mm-hmm.
And it's now, in the state of Victoria, it is now the case that if a woman wants to procure a termination after 24 weeks, the process that she will undergo is the same as she would undertake for any other medical procedure. She would go along usually to her doctor, have a discussion about it, and get some advice, or she might go directly to an abortion service provider, and if informed consent takes place, which is like any other medical procedure, risks and benefits are explained, and she can have a termination. And after 24 weeks, the situation is still much improved from where we were before, which is that there is some limitations on her freedom to choose, but ultimately if she can make a case that it is appropriate in all her circumstances, she can also obtain a lawful abortion. So things are much, much, much better than they were.
Dr. Kennold, those limitations after 24 weeks, they sound to me as though it's a reasonable thing.
Look, I have a particular view about this, which is that because when you're talking about terminations past even 20 weeks, you're mm-hmm. talking about a fraction of 1%.
Yep.
So the vast, vast majority of terminations take place well before 20 weeks,
yep.
about 96% in the first trimester, that when you get up to that stage of pregnancy, nobody wants to be there. So
yes.
they are all sort of the most tragic of the most tragic circumstances. So, a 14-year-old girl who'd never had a period and didn't even know what pregnancy was, or a woman who has a very much wanted pregnancy and has been told all along that everything is fine, and then gets a catastrophic diagnosis that the fetus is affected with something that's mm-hmm. incompatible with life or going to make it suffer for its whole life. You know, things that are so hard that I really, again, always have the same feeling I always have, which is that unless I'm sitting in that woman's shoes, or I'm, in consultation with her and in a really in-depth way, I can't possibly make a judgment about what is right, and that if anyone is going to make that judgment, she's still best placed to do it.
Yes.
But having said that, even though I would have preferred a law that respected women at all stages of pregnancy as opposed to drawing what in some ways is an arbitrary line, I still can recognise that, there were a lot of political realities that had to be dealt with, and ultimately we still have a situation where, because most women in those situations do present with such hard cases, it is likely that two doctors have to make the judgement, but it is likely that two doctors would judge if she can make
okay.
that case that the abortion is appropriate in all circumstances, and she would be able to get a safe and lawful abortion.
And so the point I'm trying to make with this is that after 24 weeks, it is quite a big procedure, and it's also quite an emotional procedure. The fact that there's been so much political consternation about the whole thing means the community is that there's a lot of community concern about this, and people going through that at that particular time. I think it's good that there's this level of community support, and I'm quite sure there's a lot of community respect. I don't think respect is the big issue now. It's making sure the people that go through this get the best care and get the opportunity to get follow-up care and counselling if they need it.
Well, look, I guess, again, I think proper medical care would ensure that that would happen anyway. So, in other words, I always wonder why, there's a lot of medical procedures and medical interventions that we would argue have both significant things that need to be understood about physical risks and significant things that need to be understood about psychological risks. If you want to get a test for HIV, we would consider that to be quite significant. If you want to make a decision to freeze or store embryos, we would say that's quite significant. To have an open heart surgery, quite significant. And proper medical care involves an assessment and an informed consent process that ensures people understand those things and that they are referred where appropriate to counselling. So it goes back to that question of whether or not we need to continue to single out this particular procedure, when the reason that we continue to do that is because a small percentage of the population have religious objections, not just to the procedure after 24 weeks, but to the procedure in all instances, in all cases. So that's, I guess, the background for me, but I suppose it's negative in some ways to focus on what I feel are the limitations of the legislation when so many women, so 99.9% of women are going to really be, their situation is going to be much improved. And I do think that it is very important that the law move. I agree with you that the community by and large has come to the position that women are decision makers worthy of respect in the same way that men are. And so for the law to continue to have infantilized them would have been a tragedy. And so I think it's wonderful that the law has come up to speed with where the community is sitting and is able to affirm in a very clear way that women are decision makers worthy of respect, even when it comes to very important decisions, and this is a very important
one. Dr. Canold, as a bioethicist, let me throw one at you from left field, because during this show, what we're doing on Allegro today is we're catching up with the stories that we think were important ones during 2008. And the next interview I'm going to do after I've been speaking to you is I'm going to be speaking to Neil Francis from Dying with Dignity. Now, at the same time as the abortion decriminalisation went through in state parliament, the Dying with Dignity was defeated.
Yes.
Now, it strikes me as being somewhat hypocritical.
Yes, but
could I have a comment from you?
Oh, look, I am a supporter of, I'm a member of Dying with Dignity, and I'm a real supporter of, again, I agree with you that the central principle, which is about in difficult situations and when difficult decisions have to be made, who better than the person who is affected and will live with the consequences should make them. So I agree with you that it's exactly the same issue as abortion and with decisions about end of life. And I very much think that always the answer has to be that the person who is affected and will live with the consequences of the decision should make it. But then we go back to the real world in which legislation actually has to be passed. And I'm sure Neil will be able to tell you about the political ins and outs. And certainly one of the complexities has been that so many difficult social issues were on the government's agenda this year. So we had issues around same-sex relationships, we had issues around Dying with Dignity, we had issues around abortion, and we have the ART legislation, assisted reproductive technology, which is still trying to make its way through Parliament. And so part of, I think, what was going on, and again, I'd be interested in what Neil has to say, I think there was a bit of fatigue going on with the politicians, feeling like there was just too much of this stuff, and a sense, always with politics, that you want to give to one side and then you want to give to the other. So in fact, the success of one of the bills may not have been to the advantage of the other.
Okay. I think I hear what you're saying, and the government might have, it's possible they saw, look, this is just too hard to try and deal with all this at once. We'll put that in a too hard basket. Let them represent the bill at another time when we're less stressed. Although I don't think that's what they would have officially put in Hansard.
It's electoral cycles. So I think, you know, there will be another chance. This bill, in my view, it's one of those things that eventually, of course, this is going to happen. Not without, you know, the incredibly hard work of people like Neil, but of course, the day for this bill will come, and it's a tragedy that it hasn't come yet. But if you wait, we'll wait again for the right part of the electoral cycle and present again the same arguments about who should make these difficult decisions, who is worthy of respect. Of course, you know, we need to set up, you know, frameworks that make sure that there are proper controls, but of course people should be able to make these decisions. I feel really confident that we will eventually get a bill like this one.
It's when the abortion bill was passed, the decriminalisation, was there much furtive discussion in, were you around in state parliament at the time when it was going down?
Every night. Every day and every night I was pretty much there.
What was the debate like? Was it impassioned or was it more or less a fait accompli?
Oh no, it was not a fait accompli at any point. It was very, very difficult, and again, even though we had the vast majority of people in the community and less so in the parliament, but still in the parliament, that very much believe that in the right to choose, the forces against were very, very determined to try to make this debate about post-24-week terminations or post-20-week terminations. And that was duplicitous, but a very successful political strategy for them, because it immediately focused people's attention not where they were comfortable and familiar, because most people know someone who's had a termination, and most terminations take place very early in pregnancy. So that's the experience most people are drawing on, their own experience or the sister's experience or mother's experience. But they were trying to focus us where we didn't really know very much, which is that kind of tiny percentage of people who have this experience of needing to consider termination after 20 weeks. And even when you do know someone, often they won't talk about it, so you don't know you know them.
Yeah.
So it was very good strategy from their point of view, and made it so that the debate was really about this tiny fraction of women who I think we did a little bit of positive education with regard to trying to explain to people why it would be that somebody would need to consider this decision at that late stage. But as a community activist, I can tell you that that's the question that everybody always asked me. They would always say, okay, oh, of course I'm, you know, right to choose, of course. But then when they would talk about the later stage terminations, they would say, but why would anybody want a termination at that stage? You could explain it, the difficulties would largely evaporate.
Okay.
But you had to explain it because people don't know.
Okay. I just wanted, as by way of wind up, I just want to say thank you very much for contributing to Allegro and to the Community Radio Network this year. Sounds like you're in a cyclone.
I'm so sorry about that. I'm sitting by Albert Park Lake, and it is absolutely stunning out here with the black swans
Okay. Bobbing
on the water, but unfortunately the wind has
picked right.
up a little.
Just a last question. When this was being debated in State Parliament, were there any crackpots, any politicians who just went on about absolute waffle and right-wing ridiculous ranting?
Absolutely. We had two, Bernie Finn and Peter Kavanaugh. Bernie Finn was quite determined that he was going to talk it out, meaning that he was going to talk and talk and talk and talk until the vote couldn't take place. And that would have meant that I would be talking to you now and saying, oh, no, the bill still hasn't passed. It has to come back again next year. So, yes, it was very, very painful and difficult.
What about Robert Clark from Box Hill? Did he have anything to say?
Which one?
Clark from Box Hill.
He was against, and he was much more articulate, I suppose, in my view, although the same themes keep coming up, which is essentially this view that women are murderers if they do this, and that people like Clark and Finn and Kavanaugh know better than they do about what's right in their circumstance.
He's my local member, and I'm in constant...
You have a word with him.
I have lots of words with him, let me tell you. Dr. Leslie Kennell, thank you for everything.
It's been a real pleasure.
And hopefully we can catch up with you in 2009.
I hope so.
Okay. Bye. Take and care. Have a nice Christmas.
Bye-bye.
Okay. You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo on the Community Radio Network with Adam and Peter. We're catching up with a couple of issues as they played out in 2008 that will have impact right across Australia, not just here in Victoria. We'll have a music track, and then we're going to talk to Neil Francis from Dying with Dignity Victoria. You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo here on Joy 94.9 across Australia on the... I'll try that again. You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo on 3JOY and across Australia on the Community Radio Network with Adam and Peter. Joining us on the phone, we have Neil Francis from Dying with Dignity Victoria. Hello, Neil.
Ah, good afternoon.
Neil, thank you for coming on to Allegro. We want to catch up. What happened with the Dying with Dignity Act? We've just been speaking to Dr. Leslie Cannold, and we were referring to the abortion bill, and we just asked her about the Dying with Dignity thing as well, and she's as horrified as we are.
Yes, well, what happened was it went through the Legislative Council, and unfortunately, a number of members of the Legislative Council were not satisfied with the details of some of the provisions of the bill, but I am very happy to say that on the basis of the speeches that were given in the council, we've determined that a significant majority of members of the Legislative Council are actually in favour in principle. And so we, in the process of redrafting the bill, to be able to represent it at some stage, including community consultation, with further safeguards and so on that will satisfy the members.
Was there any particular safeguards that they thought didn't exist or needed some clarification?
Different members spoke to different aspects of the bill, and I have to say we believe that the bill already had a really strong suite of safeguards in it, because we looked at the Oregon legislation, we looked at the earlier Northern Territory legislation, we looked at other legislation, and we brought together a very large collection of safeguards, and this bill was actually rather conservative in some ways, but still some members were not satisfied. And I think probably as a conscience vote issue, some members felt they didn't have enough time to consider the matter fully, and therefore kind of by default fell on the no side until they were satisfied. But we believe that it's eminently achievable, and we're also calling on the Premier and the Attorney General to refer the 1988 Medical Treatment Act, which is now, of course, 20 years old, to the Victorian Law Reform Commission for full community consultation, because this would dovetail in very much with the Medical Treatment Act.
The problem, I think, that was happening with State Parliament at the time the Dying with Dignity Bill was being heard is that State Parliament had a lot of other really important social issues they were discussing, the assisted reproductive technology, the same-sex register, relationship register, and the abortion decriminalisation bill. And Dr. Cannold suggested perhaps that the government was in a little bit of social issue fatigue. What do you think?
Oh, look, I think that's right, and I think it is probably the case for not just the government but the whole of Parliament, because for many people some of these things are emotive issues and they can be a bit exhausting, and of course under those circumstances there are a lot of people who come out of the woodwork and either promote or oppose a particular cause. So members did receive a huge amount of mail and email and representations from both sides on all of these issues. So, yes, it's been a really busy year.
And you're going to represent the bill perhaps in 2009?
Well, we have a couple of approaches. What we'd really prefer is for the Attorney General to refer the Medical Treatment Act 88 to the Victorian Law Reform Commission, which is a fully resourced commission, and to ask that commission to consult fully with the community so that all concerns are taken into account, and to present the Victorian government and the Parliament with a report, as they did for abortion, because the support in the community for physician-assisted dying is almost identical at the high level it is for abortion. And we just find it a little bit inconsistent that the government would refer one matter to the Victorian Law Reform Commission and receive a report back. And they received a very good report with three different legislative options, and they picked one of those and got that through the Parliament. We believe that they should do the same thing with physician-assisted dying, because there is an absolutely dire need out there.
I thought it was somewhat hypocritical, the fact that then they passed the abortion decriminalisation, yet they didn't pass the Dying with Dignity. But I suppose that looking at it, if they were in some fatigue and they thought perhaps they weren't completely capable of making decisions that they could in good conscience refer back to, well, fair enough, but still smacks to me of hypocrisy. And I was terribly disappointed and very angry at the state government over this, because this is one of the most humane pieces of legislation we've seen in Victoria for some time.
Well, as you said earlier, I think the government had its own legislative agenda and was very busy with several significant pieces of social reform. And we believe that this one has at least as much merit as the others. So we think it's very important for the Attorney General to refer the matter to the Victorian Law Reform Commission and have that full community consultation. Because you might recall that when the abortion issue started out, there was an abortion bill that was going to go before the House. There wasn't a lot of support for it. I understand from others that maybe it was not as well drafted as it could have been. So the government actually called that in and sent it to the Victorian Law Reform Commission.
Okay.
And you're quite right. So this is a very similar issue, in that they were not satisfied with the bill that was presented, and that was put into the upper house by the Greens member for Western Metropolitan, Colleen Hartland. And they were not satisfied with that. In fact, the main issue, we believe it would have passed had the government allowed a full conscience vote. They promised previously that they would allow a conscience vote, and they did slightly in part.
They
allowed a conscience vote on the bill itself, but they did not allow a conscience vote on referring the bill to committee, because that's a procedural matter. So they actually instructed their members on their side of the House to vote as a block against referring the bill to the committee. And we believe that had it been referred to the Legislative Council Committee, that committee would have perhaps made some recommendations about the bill and represented it to the House, and it would have passed.
Okay.
So there was a sort of a half-hearted conscience vote on that.
Okay, it's two questions I want to ask you to wind up, Neil. The first one is just for our listeners. Okay, it's two questions I want to ask you to wind up, Neil. The first one is just for our listeners on the satellite network. Other states in Victoria, is dying with dignity similar to what was proposed in Victoria? Is it legal in any other states?
It is not currently legal in any other state. It was legal for about 8 months in the Northern Territory in 1996, but it is not legal in any other state. But South Australia has not one but two bills in their South Australian Parliament at the moment. There's one in the lower house and one in the upper house. And we're hoping one of those is going to get through.
Neil Francis, I just wanted to refer to you. We've done, since we spoke to you, I think it was in March this year, we've done a lot of interviews on Allegro Non Troppo, and the number of times people have told us that they've had partners who were close to death or in a situation and that they were helped over is actually remarkable. So what this bill, the Dying with Dignity bill, really is only validating and removing criminal elements of stuff that's happening quite occasionally anyway throughout Australia.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and one of the things the government has said is that abortion, when they were talking about the abortion bill, was already a matter of medical practice, but the government doesn't believe this is, and it is. But the problem is, it depends on which doctor you have and how you ask and in which institution they're providing the services,
yes, exactly,
as to whether you can get it or not. So
yes,
it's random.
But it does happen. And the other thing, when this was, were you in Parliament when this was being heard?
Yes.
Were there any crackpots?
Oh, there were some who expressed some fairly strong views, yes.
Anybody you'd like to name particularly?
Well, look, I think one that really stood out to me was Jan Kronberg, who literally compared the bill with the movie Soylent Green. I don't know if you're aware of it.
She didn't. Really?
And she said, and it's in the Hansard record if you want to check, she said that we'd all have to have I Don't Want to Die tattooed on our foreheads to protect ourselves. So there were some pretty strong views expressed in the House.
Thank goodness, because that just reminds us that State Parliament does have a sense of humour after all. That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. Neil Francis, thank you so much for all of the work that you do on behalf of the community with the Dying with Dignity legislation. Let's hope it gets up. Please stay in touch, and we'd like to perhaps follow this up with you again in the near future.
Terrific. It's
okay.
A pleasure.
Okay, thank you.
Thank
okay,
you.
Bye. You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo here on the Community Radio Network. We've been talking about two of the issues that we reviewed. We've reviewed two of the issues that were fairly significant for the Australian scene, but particularly here in Victoria, that's abortion and dying with dignity.
Yes, indeed. And that reference to Soylent Green, if I remember correctly, that was a movie about how the authorities used human flesh to feed the population.
Yes, it was a movie, Charlton Heston, actually. Mm. He of extremely infamous, his stand on the guns.
On guns, yes, indeed.
And in that movie, what happened, the population was so huge, the earth was suffering huge climate change, so they couldn't produce food. The oceans were getting too hot and too watered down to be able to support planktonic life. So the only way they could feed the population was when people died, they recycled the protein and made that into biscuits.
Makes a strange kind of sense, I suppose.
Yeah, so I don't think that's going to happen with the Dying with Dignity bill, though. Fancy that woman saying that. So was it Kronberg, Kavanaugh, Finn, Clark, those state politicians that spoke out somewhat vociferously against both of those bills. So we'll just remember those when it comes. I think we're having a state election next year.
Mm.
I love state elections and federal elections. Oh, yes, to get the politicians in to justify themselves. It's great. I love it. Allegro will be continuing on. We'll be playing some specials in Allegro over the summer season. We're fully fledged back in February, but there'll be Allegro specials happening over the next 3 months on the Community Radio Network. Thanks for listening to Allegro Non Troppo. If you'd like more information, you can go to the Allegro website, allegro.org.au. That's allegro.org.au for information and podcasts.